Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, as usual, and today we're going to be talking about, amongst other things, meteorites or meteors or meteoroids or asteroids. But you've all seen a shooting star, and you sort of vaguely know that something just fell to Earth from outer space. Well, to take us through this journey, we have someone who actually knows El Paso. He's up there at the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario, just outside of Toronto, Professor Peter Brown. Peter, welcome to Science Studio.
Thanks very much, Keith. Great to be here.
Well, absolutely. We're looking forward to this. And before we get into meteoroids, asteroids, and all those other objects flashing around the universe, tell us a little bit about Peter Brown. How did you get into your scientific career?
Right. Well, like many people, I got very interested in science at a young age. I think for me, the one incident that really got me interested was a grade four teacher, actually, who was very interested in the night sky and amateur astronomy, and she got me very engaged in looking at the sky, and I basically became an amateur astronomer at a young age and never looked back.
And your parents sort of helped you by getting a telescope and all that good stuff?
Yes, yeah, they were very very supportive, getting you the telescope, that sort of thing. And unlike a lot of amateur astronomers, very early on I also specialized. I became very interested in meteors, probably just a few years after getting involved in astronomy in general. And that sort of persisted up till the current day.
Okay, so tell us, what is a meteor? What's the distinction? I noticed on your website, I was looking it up, meteors, meteorites, meteoroids, asteroids. Are they just size variations? Tell us, what is a meteor and what are these different designations?
Right. Well, the common usage is any solid object, small solid object in orbit around the sun is a meteoroid. When a meteoroid interacts with or impacts a planetary atmosphere, the light, heat, and sound phenomena is called a meteor. And if some of the meteoroid is able to survive to reach the surface of the Earth, we call that a meteorite. There are some scales and degrees. So, for instance, a typical shooting star you might see outside at night, we would certainly call a meteor. That's the light phenomena. If it's very bright, as bright or brighter than, say, the brightest planet, like Venus, we might call that a fireball. If it's extremely bright, something that sort of leaves the amount of energy that's comparable to a nuclear weapon, we actually call that an airburst. And those are sort of the common terms used in the field.
Well, I do remember, well, maybe 20 years ago, there was a big meteorite, or, well, I'll stand corrected, you tell me what it was. I think the term that you used in a paper was a super bolide that came over the sky in El Paso, Texas. And, in fact, you published a paper about that. Lots of authors. Tell us about how you go about studying these events.
Right. Well, when we get a very bright event like the El Paso super bolide back in 1997, you know, typically either there's some sensors, or if it's over an area with people, of course, we get a lot of visual reports, people talking about a bright fireball. And then if it's particularly energetic, or if there are meteorites that are recovered, we'll often go out and try to piece together sort of forensically things like its path through the atmosphere, its orbit, and so on. The sort of broad, overarching science goal is to take the material that we have in the lab, the meteorites that we can study and do chemistry and isotopic analysis on, and provide a context for that material. And that context is, what orbit was it in before it hit the planet? So it's like a poor man's version of a spacecraft sample return mission.
Sort of like, in a sense, a fingerprint, too, because if you are doing analyses of the meteorites, you're learning something about not just what their orbit, as you put it, is, but also how far out into space, maybe where they've even come from in the first place.
Oh, absolutely. With modern analysis techniques, a meteorite is like a window into the early solar system. It really is telling you a story that with a lot of work and analysis and looking at it with many different instruments, you can piece together everything from when it first formed to when it was blown off of a larger object to even things like its sort of recent orbit in space, all sorts of things.
And what's the most interesting thing that you can think of that you have discovered in your sort of journey into this field over the years you've been doing it? Something that really came out of, well, I was going to say left field, but left universe.
Right. Well, I've been fortunate to be involved in lots of these big fireball meteorite producers. Probably the most unusual and interesting for me personally was a meteorite that fell in northern Canada in 2000. It fell near a lake called Tagish Lake on January 18th, 2000. It was a very, very big event. It was a very large object, several meters across. But what made it so unusual was the material. It was a very friable, ultra-rare kind of meteorite. In fact, it was a meteorite that we had never really seen before. So here we had a complete picture of where this came from. This object exploded over over the Yukon in northern Canada, deposited a whole bunch of meteorites on a lake surface in northern British Columbia, and we picked up hundreds of these pieces, and they've turned out to be completely unique, very unusual, very strange, probably from something far out in the outer asteroid belt in the solar system. And that certainly has proven probably the most interesting of all the events I've looked at over the years.
Well, tell us a little bit more then. First of all, for our audience and for me maybe, what is friable in your terminology?
Well, friable, if you think of rocks, if you go and pick up a rock outside, a typical rock, you know, it's hard, you put it down, and it's the sort of thing that isn't going to break apart if you put it on the tabletop. A meteorite like Tagish Lake is actually more like frozen soil. It's really loosely held together material, and that is telling you that it really is material from the early solar system that has been, really hasn't been thermally altered very much. It hasn't undergone the kinds of metamorphic and other processes that virtually all rocks on Earth go through. It really is more like soil than it is a rock, and that's, again, telling you something about how really primitive that material is. Very unusual. I'd never seen any meteorite like Tagish Lake when we first started recovering it.
And so when you analyze these things, you say it's a window into the history of the solar system and the universe. How do you tell age in those things? I mean, one knows about carbon-14 dating here on Earth, but then there's not too much carbon, I suspect, in some of this material.
Right. There actually can be some carbon. In fact, Tagish Lake is one of the most carbon-rich of all meteorites. It's 3 or 4 weight percent carbon. But it is true, we wouldn't use carbon-14 to do an ultimate dating, in part because carbon-14 only goes back a few tens of thousands of years, and the age of these objects is in the billions of years. So we use different isotopic systems, uranium or lead, there's a number of others, and we extract isotopes of these particular elements, and by looking at their ratios in the object, we can get an idea of how old the material is when it first formed, when the isotopic clock was set, as it were, and we typically end up with numbers like 4.56 billion years. That's the time period in which much of the solids in the early solar system first condensed.
And that's because you've got radioactive materials that are sort of slowly decaying, and that's how you can give rise to a sort of an age.
That's exactly correct. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of different isotopic systems. Some of them have a radioactive isotopes, and we can use that then as sort of a clock, just like carbon-14 for organic material. The carbon-14 provides that clock. We use other isotopes that have longer half-lives, longer amounts of time between decays, to sort of be able to estimate times going way back into the early solar system.
Let's go back to the need, in fact, to collect meteorites. You can't go out there and grovel around and go under the lake's surface to do this for yourself. But luckily, there are a lot of people out there that are very interested in finding a piece of a meteorite. If people come to you and say, oh, look, we've got some of this material that fell over the Yukon, and would you like it? Do they like to get it back, or do you just keep this and it sort of goes into the repository of meteorite samples?
Right. Well, there are many people now who are collectors of meteorites, very active, very interested in going out and collecting meteorites for their own interest. There is a monetary aspect to it. You know, meteorites do have a monetary value. I'd say in the last 10 years in particular, the collector area or the collector field has really exploded. There's a lot of very active collectors, people who go out after there's been a meteorite fall, will try to collect meteorites. This is really, in my view, a boon for science, because
right,
a lot of these meteorites, you know, there aren't that many scientists. We don't have huge amounts of either time or resources to go out finding these meteorites. So we rely on the public, and in particular these meteorite hunters, professional and otherwise, to go out and collect these things. And so it's been great. We get lots more samples, And many people, after they find meteorites, you know, they want the meteorites analyzed. Are these really meteorites?
And, well, exactly. I mean, that's my point. Yeah. There's no value if you don't know exactly something about it, and that brings in the scientist.
Right. Yeah, so often with modern analytical techniques, you know, we don't need huge amounts of a meteorite to do a lot of basic detail of, you know, what is this meteorite, why is it special? And to have meteorites officially designated, there's an international society called the Meteoritical Society, and they have certain requirements that if you want a meteorite officially recognized and named, you do have to have some of that material deposited somewhere permanently in a scientific or you know, a university or a museum that then provides the analysis. And that's a great sort of win-win. The person who found the meteorite gets it named and analyzed, and science gets to have a small amount of this, at least, to ensure that people can study it both now and in the future.
And so there are certain depositories all around the world. I mean, presumably universities would be one of the first places since they've got the analytical equipment. So do all universities have designated collections as per this particular international society?
Not necessarily. Some universities are more active than others. Some universities don't have much in the way of meteorite collections. But in general, as long as some material is put, you know, ultimately donated to either a museum or, you know, some sort of a university, you know, a science a collection that has a long-term sort of archival or curatorial component, then that meets the requirements for the Meteoritical Society. So you don't have to necessarily have a university with a big collection, as long as they have some place where, you know, it can be on deposit and it isn't going to get lost.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Our guest this week is Peter Brown. He's a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Okay, I've seen my wife go to a makeup counter and try on samples and thought, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, but they clean those off between uses, right?
They're supposed to, but a woman in New York is suing a cosmetics company to get the industry to provide individual disposable samples. She claims she got herpes from a lipstick an employee applied on her.
Is that possible?
Maybe. She claimed 2 days after she tried the sample, her lips swelled and she was diagnosed with a cold sore. Cold sores come from an infection with the herpes simplex virus type 1, or HSV-1, and there's no cure.
The virus stays dormant in nerve cells until reactivated by anything from sun exposure to emotional distress. Up to 90% of adult Americans have been exposed to HSV-1. For most people, these infections are rarely serious. But HSV-1 infections of the eye is a leading cause of blindness in the U.S.
The woman suing may have acquired a primary HSV-1 infection from the lipstick if a previous customer had an active infection, but she may have simply reactivated a latent HSV-1 she already had.
It'll be challenging for her to prove the cold sore came from the lipstick sample, but it is possible to contract a variety of bacteria from sharing makeup, especially eye makeup. Samples of makeup displays reveal half, and on busy weekends, all samples contain bacteria like Staphylococcus, Micrococcus, Pseudomonas, and even E. coli.
We don't know if makeup samples can harbor viruses, but some viruses are very stable, so it's possible. If you insist on trying makeup, take precautions. Try squeeze lotions. Ask makeup to be cleaned with alcohol. Lipstick with the top scraped off. And don't share makeup brushes.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Peter Brown, Professor of Physics and Astronomy, University of Western Ontario, London, Ontario. And we're talking about meteors, meteorites. And let's just go to that other terminology that we see sometimes in the literature, an asteroid. What makes an asteroid different from some of these other materials?
Right. Well, asteroids are small objects in the solar system, small bodies, typically orbit between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. We normally think of them as sort of fairly rocky, don't have necessarily a lot of ices on them. There is another category of small objects called comets, and these are, you could think of them as water, ice-rich sort of asteroids. These tend to orbit further out in the solar system. When they get close to the sun, the ices sublimate. You get a very extended atmosphere and a tail and so on. But the principal distinction, when you look through a telescope, an asteroid looks star-like, and a comet, when it's closer to the sun, will have sort of a diffuse view to it because of its atmosphere.
We have a friend very close up here, Alan Hale, who was one of the co-first observers of the Hale-Bopp comet just about 10 years ago. And it was that was a tremendously visible comet. Do you sometimes scan the stars with your telescope trying to be the first one to find a new comet?
I do look at comets after they've been discovered. Currently, there are lots and lots of professional telescopic survey programs, primarily looking for near-Earth asteroids. But one byproduct of these searches is they tend to find almost all of the comets these days. So the era when amateur astronomers like Alan Hale and Thomas Bopp and David Levy and many others find lots and lots of comets, that era is somewhat coming to an end, sadly, just because of the proliferation of these really automated, advanced programs. So I don't look for comets myself, but I do sometimes go out and look at ones that have been found and are visible.
Were you old enough to remember Kohoutek?
No, Kohoutek was before my time. I think my first comet was Comet Halley back in 1985-86.
Okay, because I remember looking at Kohoutek, and I never actually saw it. I mean, it was so hyped up, but I just couldn't see it. Maybe I had too much city light. Let's go on to some of these events that have happened in Russia. There was this phenomenal some incident where something, obviously a meteorite or a meteor or whatever, came into the Earth's atmosphere. And I think you were involved in that particular investigation. Run the audience through the sort of the history of that event and what you really could learn from such a massive intrusion onto the space of the Earth.
Right, Friday, February 15th, 2013, about 9:20 a.m., people in and around the region of Chelyabinsk in Russia, which is sort of in Central Asia, were witness to an exceptionally bright fireball. This fireball lasted about 15 seconds, and very, very bright. People under or near the path actually had the sky light up brighter than the noonday sun. There was that much energy. What was extraordinary about this event, there were several things that are extraordinary. One, there were thousands of meteorites that were dropped. That's unusual, although not perhaps as extraordinary as the fact that the detonation, the explosion of the object about 30 kilometers in altitude, produced a shockwave strong enough to blow out lots of windows in the Chelyabinsk area. And Chelyabinsk is a major urban area. It's over 1 million people. So you can imagine such a strong shockwave in an urban area will, of course, do lots of damage. And that's unusual, unprecedented. We've never seen anything like that in modern times, certainly not in or near an urban area. And the energy, this object, as it turns out, was about 20 meters in diameter, about the size of a six-story building, weighed about 12,000 metric tons, and came into the atmosphere at about 19 kilometers a second. So over a period of a few seconds, it lost about 500,000 tons of TNT equivalent energy, which is...
That's a nuclear bomb, for goodness sake.
It is. It is very much. The energy released was basically that of a fairly modern nuclear weapon, typical yield of a fairly modern nuclear weapon, and that was all released in just a few seconds, fortunately at quite high altitude. So while there was damage at the ground, it could have been much worse. If the energy had been released, say, at 5 or 10 kilometers altitude, there would have been much, much more damage at the ground.
Does it have a name?
Yeah, the meteorite is called the Chelyabinsk meteorite, and the airburst, the energy associated with it, is often called just the Chelyabinsk airburst.
So the Chelyabinsk meteorite, tell us a little bit about its composition. Was it from way, way back in time, or was that more recent? Just tell a little of the history and why it was a surprise, in fact. That's another interesting point, I gather. We didn't see it. We didn't predict it. So why?
Right. So the Chelyabinsk, the meteorite associated with the Chelyabinsk airburst, the Chelyabinsk meteorite, is a relatively common kind of meteorite. It's called an ordinary chondrite. It originally formed and comes from the inner part of the asteroid belt. Sometime about 1 million years ago, it was knocked off of a larger body, and through a variety of forces, radiation forces, and perhaps forces due to the gravitational tugs of the other planets, it ended up on an orbit that crossed the Earth. And this past February, as it was moving around the sun, it was coming out of the sun from the perspective of the Earth. And, of course, the Earth and the object happened to be in the same place at the same time. And so it hit. But that's also why we didn't see it. It was coming out of the sun. And so from the ground, you could not see that part of the sky. The sun, it was too close to the sun. And that's why it was a surprise.
Well, I mean, that leads to the question, how many more surprises are there? And six stories seems pretty big. There must be things out there even bigger.
There are, yeah. There are lots of asteroids across the orbit of the Earth. Things the size of Chelyabinsk, there are several million of those, of which we've detected and cataloged and have orbits for about 1,000, so a very tiny fraction of a percent of the total population. Most of those objects are only found when they get close to the Earth, and so you can imagine every few decades to maybe a century, one of these objects will hit the Earth, and more often than not, certainly right now at least, an object like that hitting the Earth will not have been discovered beforehand. It will, if it's discovered at all, it might only be discovered a few days out, and then the prediction would be, that a few days it'll hit us. Larger objects are also out there. There's about 1,000 objects, 1,000 near-Earth asteroids, larger than a kilometer in size. Happily, 95% of those objects have now been found. We know their orbits. We know that of all the ones we found, none of them are going to hit the Earth in the next 100 years. So in terms of things hitting the Earth and being concerned about impact damage, those big ones are the ones to really worry about. And happily, we've got information that tells us those really aren't something we have to worry about for the next 100 years or so.
But only 95%.
Right. There still are a few tens of these really big objects out there, any one of which has a very low chance of hitting us. On average, something like a kilometer in sized object hits once every 500,000 to 1,000,000 years on the Earth. So it really is unlikely any one of the ones that we haven't yet discovered would be likely to hit us in the next few years. And the way surveys are going right now, we'll probably approach 97-98% completion over the next few years to decade. So we really should know in the next 10 years with almost certainty if there's any large object out there that could be a danger to us in the next 100 years. The odds are extremely low that that would be the case.
So we can sleep soundly in bed tonight. And, of course, that means that the people who are going looking for these will have finished their research careers or research projects, and you have to look at something else.
Well, certainly, yeah, in terms of the big objects, that's true. Of course, there are quite a lot of smaller objects out there that we don't have as much completion, and even things a few hundred meters in size, we've only found a few tens of percent of those, and those could still produce explosions or craters at the Earth that would be very damaging over a large area, the size of a state, though it may not be as globally devastating as a 1 kilometer size impactor. So I think the surveys will be running now for probably quite a few more decades, I suspect.
Let's talk about that, because I remember reading about this part of northern Russia. I don't quite know where it is in relation to Chelyabinsk, but the whole concept of this large area where all the trees had been sort of devastated, somewhere up in the Arctic Circle or close to it. That was also a similar event some time ago?
Yeah, the event you're talking about is called the Tunguska event. That happened on June 30th, 1908. And at that time, something like between 3 and 15 megatons of energy were released, so probably more than 10 times the size of Chelyabinsk. And what made that airburst so unique was, A, well, of course, the energy was very, very energetic, and B, it was so big it got very close to the ground. So a lot of the energy reached the ground. It was such an intense airburst that it actually set fire to a large chunk of the taiga near the Podkamnaya-Tunguska River in Siberia. That fire lasted only a brief period of time before the air blast came in and felled the trees and put out the fire.
Is there something special about this type of material hitting in the northern hemisphere near the poles, or is that just pure chance?
I think that's pure chance. Siberia is a big place, so it's a big target in terms of land area. But these two impacts are not related. So as far as we know, there's no connection. And even if they were somehow related, the actual place where they hit on the Earth is pretty much random. So Canada, for example, could also be in the crosshairs just because our land size is so large.
Okay. So there's no particular reason for if you're on the equator, you're just as statistically likely to see meteorites and the landing of a meteorite onto the Earth. It's random in terms of location.
Yes, it is basically random with location. There is a slight trend as you go towards the pole that there's a slightly smaller number of meteorites and fireballs, but it's a very slight change. So effectively, it's the same pretty much everywhere.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, but I remember many years ago going to an American Chemical Society meeting and popping into the geochemistry group. And it was just interesting to me that the passion with which this very small group of people were talking about carbon-13, carbon-12 ratios. These are two isotopes of carbon, and neither of them are radioactive. And yet, what is it that makes, therefore, that particular ratio vary from source to source? Because they were saying they could sort of say, well, this piece of meteorite originally came from Mars, for example.
Right. Well, often we do use carbon isotope dating for meteorites where we're trying to look for the residence time of the meteorite on the Earth. You know, how long has the object been on the Earth? But normally when we're looking at, trying to discover things about the earlier history, you know, when it was blown off the asteroid or how long it's been in space, we look at other isotopes. Things like neon, for example, is commonly used for trying to understand how long something's been as a smaller object in space. And then if you go back
earlier... Did you say neon?
Neon is commonly used, yeah.
So where does the neon come in? Neon, for the people who don't know, is a gas. It's an inert gas, a noble gas anyway. How does that get stored in the meteorite? Just sort of encapsulated?
Right, yeah. So what happens is if an object gets... A bigger object gets collides and blows off a small object, say a meter or so in size, there's high-energy particles in space called cosmic rays, generically, and these particles, when they hit some of the target atoms in this smaller body, will produce isotopes that are of all kinds of elements, but among them will be radioactive isotopes of neon, and the neon does get trapped in the rock and has the added property that it's not chemically active, so it's a very common way of...
Sticks around. Well, we cannot stick around, Peter Brown. We've run out of our time. I'd like to thank you very much for being here on Science Studio. It's a fascinating area. One question. Do you actually travel very much to go to see the sites of where things have happened, or you just wait for people to mail in the chunk of rock?
I certainly do go out in the field occasionally if we have a big event. We have lots of cameras all over Canada and the U.S., and sometimes we get big meteorite falls, in which case we go out and try to find meteorites, talk to farmers,
but
and collect them.
But you did not hoof off to Chelyabinsk.
I did not.
Didn't go out there.
No, I had lots of classes, lots of teaching, unfortunately, this past year, so I didn't have a chance to do that.
Well, thank you very much. I'll let you go. You get back to preparing your notes for your next class. And Peter Brown, Professor of Physics and Astronomy, University of Western Ontario, it's been a tremendous pleasure to have you on Science Studio.
Thanks. I've enjoyed it, Keith.
And Norma Martinez, we'd like to thank you for putting it all together, and we'd like to thank you and the audience for listening to Science Studio. Take care.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Manuel de la Rosa, founding dean of the Paul Foster School of Medicine, recently received the title of Hispanic Physician of the Year. The National Hispanic Medical Association presents the honor annually to a doctor who has played a significant leadership role in the health of Hispanics. The association represents more than 40,000 U.S. Hispanic physicians. Read more at the region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.